Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, there's still time to catch the Orlando Collected exhibit at the Orange County Regional History Center during the city's 150th anniversary.
The main thing that I hope visitors take away from this exhibit is that they have a pivotal role in preserving our history.
We'll discuss Fort Myers in the Civil War.
The reoccupation of the fort by U.S. military in 1864 proved to be a considerable irritant to Florida Confederates on several levels.
And we'll talk about the new book of photography, Abandoned Vehicles of the Everglades. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The Georges Bizet opera Carmen premiered in Paris in 1875. That same year, the city of Orlando was established in the much more remote area of Central Florida. Sebastian Garcia takes us to the Orlando Collected exhibit.
Katie Kelly serves as a curator of exhibitions at the Orange County Regional History Center. To commemorate the 150th anniversary of the city of Orlando, the History Center created a special exhibition titled Orlando Collected that showcases 150 artifacts collected from Orlando's history.
As really the primary historical museum in Orlando, we felt a strong responsibility to mark that significant milestone in some way. And so we wanted to do something that would really be unique to us and something that would really showcase the work that we do for our community. So we decided to put on an exhibition that highlights 150 items from our collection. So our historical collection houses lots of artifacts, photographs, oral histories, documents from across the Central Florida region. And so we thought it was a really great way for us to highlight some of the items that we've been caring for throughout the city's history that relate to Orlando.
Katie walked me through the special exhibit, which is organized thematically rather than chronologically, partly because of the community-driven, object-focused process that guided its curation.
This exhibit is actually community-curated, and so by that we mean that many of the objects that are on display were actually selected for display by people outside of the exhibition's development team, so people outside of the History Center's collections management team and the History Center's exhibitions team. Those are the two entities that developed the exhibition. And so about half of the items that are on display were curated from outside of that team. So that's part of it. The other part of it was we wanted to make the objects the focus, the act of preserving the objects and what that does in terms of preserving history overall. We really wanted that to be the focus of the exhibit, so we wanted the theme to really focus on the objects and not necessarily the history of Orlando overall. So as you enter the exhibit, you're first greeted by our title wall, which has the word Orlando lit up and then the word collected in sort of a handwriting font that we had custom made, and a curio cabinet that lights up with silhouettes of objects that represent things that are in the exhibit. So the design concept for this exhibit was intended to reinforce one of our core themes, which is that the community is central to preserving our history because the community are the ones who collect the items that then come to us to save for long-term care. And so we chose a curio cabinet as sort of a representation of that because that is the way people collect history in their own homes. And so it's sort of that references that personal act of preserving history. And then in addition, the font choices that we use, things like that, to represent sort of handwriting that's like an individual person documenting history, saving their story so that it then can then be referenced by future generations.
The first artifact on display originates from the meeting to officially incorporate Orlando in 1875.
The first artifact that you encounter in the exhibition is the actual minutes book from 1875 when they held the meeting to incorporate. So this is actually on loan to us from the city of Orlando. So it's a large bound volume. It is preserved by the city clerks.
Despite its thematic focus, the first section of the exhibit highlights some of the earliest artifacts from Orlando's history, including the oldest known photograph of the city and a diary belonging to a Swedish teenage girl from the 1880s.
We also have the oldest known photograph of the city of Orlando, and this we believe dates back to the late 1870s. And it's a picture of Orange Avenue looking north, but it's very rutted and pockmarked and very much does demonstrate that Orlando was a frontier city at the time, a frontier town. We have Kina Fry's diary. So she was an immigrant that came to the area with her family when she was a teenager in the 1880s. So we actually have a collection of items related to her, of some of her personal items. She kept diaries and scrapbooks. And then she also was an early historian of the city. So she is one of the key individuals that have helped us understand what life was like in Orlando in the past.
Education constitutes one of the first thematic sections, and items on display include artifacts from the former Orlando High School and Orlando Colored School.
It is one of the early high schools in the area and has some pretty famous alumni. So probably most notable for many people in Orlando is John Young, who was an astronaut who has pretty significant accolades. He was a graduate of Orlando High School. And these two items that we have related to John Young are a mission patch from Apollo 16 and a flag that he carried on board with him from the state of Florida flag from the Apollo 16 mission, and then also the Space Shuttle Columbia mission. One thing that we're highlighting in this section particularly is the earliest known photo of one of the African-American schools. It's labeled as Colored School, and it would have been from the year 1890. So a really early school that was the precursor to the precursor to the precursor to what would have become Jones High School. So that photo album is interesting and gives us a look at some of the communities that maybe have not been preserved as well as some of the other history in the area. So it's actually pretty interesting and unique.
The Getting Down to Business section of the exhibit showcases artifacts from various local businesses throughout Orlando's history.
Most of these items have been selected by different individuals in the community. We also have Brownie Wise's dress. So Brownie Wise was a pretty remarkable woman. She was not the owner of Tupperware, but she is greatly responsible for the success of Tupperware in the mid-century. And Tupperware, if people aren't aware, was actually headquartered in Orlando. And she popularized the in-home marketing method. So having parties in your home, so those Tupperware parties that became popular, and then of course, different industries started to then mimic that. That was all Brownie Wise. And so she was actually a really kind of brilliant businesswoman. So we have her dress on display. As I have toured various people through this exhibition, a lot of them recognize this Ivy's drugstore sign. It was owned initially by a gentleman who went by the name Doc Ivy, and it was originally on Orange Avenue downtown. And then once Orange Avenue extended further south into what we now call, you know, SoDo or South Downtown, he actually reopened his store down on the corner of Orange and Grant Avenue. And so lots of people, when they visit this exhibit, if there's folks that have been around for a while, they recognize that sign. We designed a couple of custom display cases to go along with the theme. So this case is intended to look like a curio cabinet. It's double-sided. And so on this side, we have more items related to local businesses. So one of the beloved Orlando institutions is Ronnie's Deli. And so we have a pewter plate and we have the closing procedures that had existed on corkboard in their back of house for many years that told folks how they're supposed to close down the bakery cases and things. We also have an early Red Lobster menu and the Gary's Duck Inn menu. So Gary's Duck Inn was actually sort of the precursor to Red Lobster. It was the inspiration for Red Lobster, which was also headquartered in Orlando, Red Lobster was. So we have a milk bottle and a milk box from T.G. Lee Dairy, which opened in 1925 and, of course, is one of our prominent businesses in the area and has been for the past 100 years.
Sports comprises another thematic section of the exhibit, and artifacts range from Tinker Field seats to a basketball shoe signed by the 1992 Orlando Magic team.
One significant one is the seats from Tinkerfield. This was, of course, located in Paramore. And historical significance in the sports world in that it was home to spring training for some national teams, but then also when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. visited in, I believe, 1964, he actually delivered a speech at Tinkerfield. So we do have a few of the seats from Tinkerfield. We have the dedication plaque from Tinkerfield. We also have a shoe that is signed by the 1992 Orlando Magic team, and that is in Shaquille O'Neal's rookie year. So it is not Shaquille O'Neal's shoe. That's one thing every time I bring people through, they want to say, that's not big enough to be Shaquille O'Neal's. And it is a basketball shoe that was signed by the whole team. And so he did actually, Shaquille O'Neal did sign it on the toe in his rookie year.
Most people today associate Orlando tourism with the theme parks, and the exhibit recognizes that with a section titled Major Attractions. A major omission, however, is Disney, primarily because it falls outside the official bounds of the city, which constituted a major objective in curating items for the exhibition. But its absence also allows the exhibit to challenge common perceptions about Orlando as a place that only exists because of Disney.
Disney is certainly instrumental to Orlando's history because of some of the development that occurred because of it. But there is that residual effect that people don't think of Orlando as a place with a rich and complex history like it has, because the perception of Orlando is that Disney's the only thing here until you actually visit and you learn that, you know, well before Disney, not only was there things happening in Orlando and industry in Orlando, but also other tourist destinations in Orlando well before Disney. So Walt chose us because of the infrastructure and already established tourism industry here, not the other way around. So
the exhibit acknowledges Orlando's rich immigrant history by displaying artifacts related to the various immigrant communities across the city.
So this section has items relating to some of the immigrant communities in the city of Orlando. We are, of course, a very diverse city, a city that has a large Hispanic population and a large Vietnamese population. And so we have some items related to that in this section here. One of the things on display is a video that was actually given to us by Nancy Alvarez. She was the first reporter from the Central Florida area that went to Puerto Rico to report on Hurricane Maria and the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in 2017. Hurricane Maria was actually significantly impactful in Orlando as well because of the demographic shifts that happened in its aftermath. Similarly, the city of Orlando did have a lot of refugees from Vietnam following the Vietnam War. We have on display a menu from Little Saigon, which is a restaurant that is, of course, in the Mills 50 district, which has a strong Vietnamese influence. And then we also have a briefcase that was owned by Thomas Nguyen, and he was a refugee that came here, and then he actually was a strong activist and advocate for helping Vietnamese people relocate. And so he was a teacher in Vietnam. This is his briefcase from when he was a teacher in Vietnam. And then after he came here, he became a community leader and advocate for the Vietnamese population and helping people resettle here.
The section titled Pride and Resilience highlights Orlando's LGBT plus community, with its most notable artifact originating from the 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting.
We have this section dedicated to items that relate to Orlando's LGBT plus community. So perhaps most notably, and probably at the forefront of our minds as we approach the 10-year anniversary of the Pulse tragedy, we have a couple items related to that. One is the stop sign from the Pulse parking lot. The stop sign underneath it, someone has written in Sharpie, "The Hate," so it actually reads, "Stop the Hate."
In addition to artifacts that proved challenging to categorize thematically and a few oral history clips, the exhibit ends with an explicit call to action to help enrich the History Center's overall collection.
It really goes back to the core idea of this exhibit, which is that this collection exists because of the community's involvement with our organization, and also for the community, to be a resource for the community. And so that call to action was important to us, to invite folks to think about what should be preserved from their own lives, how they preserve it, and sort of thinking of, if not our organization, any organization that has the capability to save things for posterity, to consider doing so. We did actually set up an email that folks can reach out to if they have ideas for things. It's OrlandoCollected@OCFL.net. That'll go directly to our collections department, and they can sort of vet and determine if it fits our collecting scope, if it's something that fills a gap in our collection, those sort of things.
When I asked Katie what she hopes visitors learn from the Orlando Collected Special Exhibit, she responded with the following.
The main thing that I hope visitors take away from this exhibit is that they have a pivotal role in preserving our history. I want them to understand that it's important to preserve history, and I want them to understand that that starts with the individuals that are living in a community to preserve that community's history. So we can only keep and care for and research from the things that are made available to us. And so ultimately, it starts with the people who are creating history by living their lives. And so that's the main thing I want people to come away with, is that preserving history starts with you. And we are a partner in that, and we want to continue to be a partner in that.
To learn more about Orlando Collected, please visit the exhibition at the History Center before it ends on January 11th, 2026. For more information about hours, directions, and pricing, visit their website at www.thehistorycenter.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, as the third state to secede, Florida was an eager supporter of the Confederacy and contributed a number of men to the Southern Army, but it was not the site of many major battles.
That's correct, but Florida did play an important role in the Civil War, especially after the U.S. cut off access to the cattle-raising regions of the Trans-Mississippi. Late in the war, as the movement of cattle from Florida to Georgia became critical to feeding Southern troops, Florida's importance rose. Union strategists hoped to cut off access to beef by focusing on two areas, one in the northern part of the peninsula and one in the southwestern region. The Southwestern Initiative centered on Fort Myers, a Seminole War installation that had been abandoned in 1858. As Irvin D. Solomon in his 1993 article, Southern Extremities, The Significance of Fort Myers in the Civil War, argued, the reoccupation of the fort by U.S. military in 1864 proved to be a considerable irritant to Florida Confederates on several levels. First, although Confederates had become accustomed to the federal embargo and its enforcement by the Union East Gulf blockading squadron, as well as the periodic raids along the West Coast, they were less willing to tolerate a permanent federal post in South Florida. They understood that the presence of the U.S. soldiers represented a serious threat to the cattlemen supplying the Confederate armies. Finally, and perhaps equally important, the Union commanders decided to staff the fort with soldiers from the U.S. colored troops.
By 1864, South Florida, like many parts of the Confederacy, was awash with competing views on the war, and loyalties were not as clear-cut as they had been 3 years earlier.
That's right. Many South Floridians were willing to serve in the Home Guard, but resisted conscription to fight in Georgia and Virginia. Indeed, Solomon notes that General P.G.T. Beauregard, commander of the military department in South Florida, and Florida Governor John Milton issued conditional pardons to those who had evaded conscript officers in the hopes of wooing them back to the cause. So you had the U.S. military seeing an opportunity to cut off the food supply to the Confederate Army, a small Confederate military presence determined to protect the supply lines, and a large group of farmers and cattlemen vacillating between the two forces. Finally, there were those black soldiers, the Confederates' worst nightmare, armed blacks in the very heart of South Florida. Solomon reports that Union commanders, quote, often vacillated on the issue of emancipation, but the presence of black troops encouraged self-emancipation by area slaves. As one Confederate observer noted, events changed after the placement of U.S. colored troops at Fort Myers. Quote, it was a war for possession of this country. The federal troops, mostly Negroes, made a move to go through the country to burn, destroy, and capture everything from Fort Myers, end quote.
Connie, this conflict between opposing armies over production and movement of cattle transformed into a larger ideological and cultural conflict, right?
Indeed it did, and it often pitted people against one another on the same side. The presence of the Union Army encouraged refugees to seek safety in the fort, but Unionists were frequently appalled by the presence of black troops, who also tried to protect men and women escaping slavery. In what quickly became overcrowded conditions, the tensions were high at Fort Myers. For their part, the Confederates created the Florida Special Cavalry, or Cow Cavalry, to, quote, repulse the now frequent Union forays, protect Confederate cattle herds, and stem the rising tide of desertion, end quote. Things came to a head in the winter of 1865, when the Confederates, under the command of Major William Footman and a force of 275 men, marched out of Tampa, planning a surprise attack in the late evening or early morning. On February 20, 1865, the Confederate forces confronted the troops at Fort Myers. Although the Confederates had the troops and armament superiority, they withdrew after 11 hours and returned to Fort Meade. An eyewitness reporter from the New York Times wrote that, quote, the colored troops were in the thickest of the bite. Their impetuosity could hardly be restrained. They seemed totally unconscious of danger, or regardless of it, and their constant cry was to get at them, unquote. On March 14, 1865, the U.S. Army completed a planned withdrawal from Fort Myers, providing the Confederates with reason to claim victory long after they left the field of battle. While Solomon recognizes the engagement at Fort Myers did not change the outcome of the war or even count as one of the more memorable battles, the history of Fort Myers, quote, affirmed the Union's ability to disrupt Confederate activity throughout South Florida's interior, confirming the validity of the federal strategy of blockading the coast, raiding the hinterland, and interdicting the critical cattle trade in South Florida, contributing to the decline of the Confederacy and its ultimate defeat, end quote.
An often overlooked part of the Civil War in Florida. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is professor of history at the University of Central Florida, director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Photographer Matt Stock and Everglades explorer Charles Kropke have created the coffee table size book, Abandoned Vehicles of the Everglades. The book contains artfully staged photographs of cars, vans, and even an airplane that were left in the Everglades as long as a century ago. Matt Stock introduced the book at the Miami Book Fair.
My partner in the book project, Charles J. Kropke, has been involved in Everglades and environmental preservation and tours, eco-tours for decades. And in my own art practice as a photographer, I've been exploring the Everglades myself for over a decade. And first met Charles, and Charles said, have you ever photographed the abandoned vehicles of the Everglades? And I said, what abandoned vehicles? And that kind of launched this multi-year project, 85 expeditions out into the night in the Greater Everglades watershed, a Knight Foundation grant, and almost a decade later, here we are with the book.
Stock says that people are often surprised at how many vehicles have been abandoned in the Everglades, and that many of them have interesting stories.
In kind of tracing and looking for some of these vehicles, some of it speaks to the history of man's interaction with the Everglades. In fact, most of them do. So a lot of these vehicles are connected with old farms that had existed or homesteads that had existed before becoming national parks or national preserves out in the wetlands. Some of them were folks that owned cabins and recreated out there and would take these vehicles out, and then they're 15 miles out and they die and there's no way to tow them out of the sugar sand. So for example, kind of midway through the book, there is a Ford Model A that was converted into a swamp buggy with dually wheels that was put on it that was abandoned about 15 miles out now in the middle of nowhere. Some of them were connected with more nefarious things. There is a drug plane that we photographed. The tail numbers were on another fixed wing aircraft and they were transferred to this and it was abandoned in a prairie. Some of them have mysterious histories that we can't even trace. But it all deals with the idea that people have always been fascinated with the Everglades going back thousands of years. And since vehicles were invented, provided them a way to get out there. And sometimes those vehicles, again, had no way to get back home.
Matt Stock chose to photograph the abandoned vehicles at night, giving some of the images a haunting ambiance.
In my art practice, I'm what's called a light painter. So I am a night photographer. I go out with a team of assistants armed with different light sources, and I direct them like a composer would where to put those lights. So instead of a woods and a string section, I've got a rocks and a trees section. So I like to control the light. It creates more of a cinematic storytelling component. So that was really the impetus behind it, was to create this hyper-realistic, almost fairy tale-like quality to the images.
Photographer Matt Stock and Everglades explorer Charles Kropke have created the book Abandoned Vehicles of the Everglades. We spoke with Matt Stock at the Miami Book Fair. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook at Florida Historical Society. Production assistance comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.